Wrong answer, said Holshek, who, with his shaved head, looks a bit like a young Telly Savalas. Holshek was in a pushy New York mood that day, prodding Hogg to recognize that this wasn't a conventional war. It was something else altogether, and it needed to be fought as such. In counterinsurgency, Holshek remembered telling the colonel, the battle space isn't physical. It's psychological. The battle is for the people. Killing people really wasn't the point, he continued. Bottom line is, you can kill every bad guy and there will be two more tomorrow, until you start focusing on their support, active or passive, in the resident population. Holshek was saying that the Iraqi people were the prize in this fight, not the playing field. Here he was introducing Hogg to classic counterinsurgency doctrine, which holds that the objective is first to gain control of the population, and then win their support. What's more, he said, moving out onto even thinner ice with his boss, your actions are having second and third order effects that will kill your soldiers down the road. I'm not selling Girl Scout cookies. In other words, this isn't just so we can be nicer. This is so we can win. I am here to keep your soldiers from getting killed. Hogg's tactics could wind up doing just that. He asked his commander to imagine himself the head of a household in an Iraqi village. 2 o'clock in the morning, your door bursts open. A bunch of infantry guys burst into the private space of the house, in a society where family honor is the most important thing, and you lay the man down and put the plastic cuffs on, and then we say, oops, wrong home. In this society, the guy has no other choice but to seek restitution, and he will do that by placing a roadside bomb for $100 because his family honor has been compromised, to put it mildly. Simply to restore his own self-respect, the Iraqi would then have to go out and take a shot at American forces. Another tactic Holshek argued against was the use of 155mm high-explosive artillery fire to respond to mortar attacks on the base. Sir, I am not a maneuver guy, he recalled saying, but the best way to respond to mortar fire is with boots on the ground. Presence patrolling, work with the Iraqi cops, get the intel, find out where it is, lie in ambush on the guy's 2 or 3 known firing points, and get the guy. Hogg didn't say much during this lecture from a subordinate, or after it, but Holshek believed he absorbed it. Then, 2 weeks later, Hogg convened his operations officer, his information operations officer, actually an artillery officer detailed to handle that task, and Holshek, and said, you guys need to fix this. In the following weeks, the brigade's operations began to change. He started to evolve, Holshek recalled. He started to shift operations, started using my CA, civil affairs teams, more effectively. Hogg began to understand that when you make a mistake, you apologize, explain how it occurred, and give the householder $100. We had much better integration of CA with the maneuver units. We had CA on raids. The wrong doors continued to be smashed on occasion, but when they did, Holshek would issue a letter that stated, we are sorry for the intrusion, we are trying to help here, and it is a difficult business, and we sometimes make mistakes. If you have information that would help us, we would be grateful. The cash equivalent in dinars of $100 would accompany the note. Those gestures of regret didn't really win over Iraqis, Holshek recalled later. But he said he thought they did tend to tamp down anger, and so curtail acts of revenge. Privately that fall, Bush administration officials were more worried than they let on in public. Officials at the White House, Pentagon, and State Department began the week of September 8 puzzling over an op-ed piece by Bremer that had appeared in the Washington Post that Monday morning. According to some accounts, the article blindsided Bush administration officials back in Washington. In it, Bremer laid out a plan for a lengthy 7-step roadmap to end the U.S. occupation. It actually boiled down to 3 major goals, in order. First, a constitution would be written and ratified by Iraqis. Next would come a national election. Only after that would U.S. occupation authority be dissolved. It was very clear to us from Bremer's leadership that he thought it would take the Iraqis a long time before they were going to be able to take over, said a CPA strategist. Bremer's plan had one huge flaw. It lacked essential support both in the United States and in Iraq. Bremer hadn't cleared the peace with his higher-ups in the Pentagon or the White House, and here he was describing a drawn-out American occupation, columnist David Brooks reported 10 months later in the New York Times. Iraqis would take their time writing a constitution, and would eventually have elections and take control of their country. For some Bush officials, this was the lowest period of the entire Iraq project. They knew they couldn't sustain an occupation for that long, yet they had no other realistic plan for transferring power to Iraqis. There was another even bigger problem looming. Ayatollah Sistani, the most important political figure in Iraq, declared it unacceptable to have a constitution prepared by unelected actors, recalled Sir Jeremy Greenstock, the British aide to Bremer. Condoleezza Rice had been growing profoundly frustrated with Bremer, a former senior administration official said. She had been receiving so little information from him that summer that, in order to assess the real state of events at the CPA and in Iraq, she began reading the diplomatic reports that the British embassy in Washington passed to her staff. Hadley and Rice were avid consumers of the inside information coming from British diplomats in Baghdad, he said. She'd been persuaded that Bremer needed to heed Sistani, and that the long-term occupation the administrator contemplated wasn't viable. Rice, in turn, took those thoughts to President Bush. In a series of meetings with Rumsfeld, and then with Rice and Bush at the White House, Bremer and the Bush administration reconsidered the mission of the CPA, and ultimately decided to abandon the idea of having the United States formally occupy Iraq for several years. The seven-step plan was dropped. On November 15, Bremer unveiled a new, swifter plan that abandoned the goal of having a constitution and general elections before the United States government relinquished sovereignty. Instead, the United States would officially hand over power less than 8 months later, at the end of June 2004. The move was startling to almost everyone involved in the occupation. The decision on 15 November came as a complete surprise to CPA administrators, remembered Hillary Sinnott, the British diplomat who was the CPA regional coordinator for southern Iraq at the time. It was indeed a major reversal. Instead of a long-term occupation, the U.S. government would seek to depart as soon as humanly possible. It was clear that Plan A wasn't going to work, said Patrick Clausen, an Iraq hawk who long had argued for limited goals. Basically, remove Saddam Hussein and leave. After more than a year of pursuing sweeping aspirations, such as transforming the politics of the Middle East, he said it was the first time we pulled back dramatically from objectives. I read that as the first time we said we weren't going to achieve everything we said we wanted to do. After the November 15 agreement, Bremer's handling of the CPA felt much more constrained, recalled Charles Costello, who worked as a contractor on local governance issues. I think from November on, he was just an administrator, he said. They were calling the shots in Washington. In the fall of 2003, knowing she faced trouble, Brigadier General Barbara Fast, the top U.S. military intelligence officer in the country, asked one of the wise men of the Army intelligence community to fly over to review her operations. The report that would result appears to have been the first major internal recognition that the U.S. effort in Iraq had run off the tracks. Retired Army Colonel Stuart Harrington was a veteran of Army counterinsurgency operations in the Vietnam War, where he was a particularly effective part of the Phoenix program, a controversial covert effort to capture or kill Viet Cong leaders in rural areas. William Colby, the CIA operative who oversaw the program and later became head of the agency, claimed that it eliminated 60,000 Viet Cong agents. That estimate has been greeted with skepticism, but after the war, observed historian Stanley Carnot, top communist figures reported that Phoenix had done enormous damage. Madame Nguyen Thi Dinh, a Viet Cong leader, told Carnot that she considered the program very dangerous. She recalled that, "We never feared a division of troops, but the infiltration of a couple of guys into our ranks created tremendous difficulties for us." Harrington was one of the last Americans out of Saigon, lifting off the roof of the U.S. Embassy at 5:30 on the morning of April 30, 1975. A few years later, he wrote a well-received book about the Phoenix operation, titled Silence Was a Weapon, The Vietnam War in the Villages. He went on to run intelligence operations for the Army in Panama and during the 1991 Gulf War, and later taught at the Army War College when Fast was a student there. She likely remembered that, unusual for an officer, he was an expert in interrogation, something that military intelligence officials tend to think of as sergeant's work. Harrington arrived in early December and was stunned by what he found. The main prison, Abu Ghraib, was stuffed with 6,000 prisoners. The problem of overpopulation at Abu Ghraib is serious and must be resolved urgently, he warned in a 13-page report to Fast submitted on December 12, 2003. The facility is a pressure cooker, where it is only a matter of time before prisoners stage an uprising. But that was the least of the problems, he concluded, because it was easily solved. A larger concern was how detainees were being treated, and not just by a handful of demoralized Army reservists at Abu Ghraib. He was shocked by the behavior of Task Force 121, an elite interagency team of about 1,000 CIA paramilitaries and black special operations forces devoted to finding Saddam Hussein and his top allies. Iraqis who had been captured by Task Force 121 showed signs of having been mistreated, beaten by their captors, he wrote, with some having injuries noted by medical personnel. Harrington was no innocent. The Phoenix program killed thousands. But he was disappointed, he wrote, with the actions of the task force, and especially the sense that it was routine and acceptable to beat prisoners. One officer told him that he knew about the beatings. I asked the officer if he had reported this problem. He replied that everyone knows about it. I advised the officer that this response was inadequate. The Red Cross likewise reported that high-value detainees were being brought in severely burned, apparently from being made to lie across the hoods of vehicles as they were transported, tied down like slain deer. Harrington, by contrast, had made a point of treating his prisoners generously, feeding a hungry Viet Cong captain in a restaurant, and putting up a captured North Vietnamese sergeant in his villa, and at one point, a week into the latter's captivity, handing him a loaded M16 rifle as a sign of trust. Broadly interpreting his mandate, Harrington went on to critique the entire U.S. military campaign. He repeatedly singled out the big sweeps that were resulting in the imprisonment of thousands of Iraqis that fall and winter. Conducting sweep operations in which many persons are detained who probably should not be detained, and who then wind up incarcerated for 3 to 6 months, is counterproductive to the coalition's efforts to win the cooperation of the Iraqi citizenry, he advised Fast. In some instances, it appeared that U.S. commanders, in seeking to shut down the insurgency in their areas of operations, were using tactics that effectively made them recruiting sergeants for it. Harrington was especially bothered by the actions of General Odierno's 4th Infantry Division, which was headquartered in Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit, near the northern apex of the Sunni Triangle. Principally due to sweep operations by some line units, the 4th ID was consistently singled out as the major offender. The number of detainees was rising steadily, he wrote. He emphasized that point 5 pages later. Some divisions are conducting operations with rigorous detention criteria, while some, the 4th ID is the negative example, are sweeping up large numbers of people and dumping them at the door of Abu Ghraib. He also told Fast to look into the practice of taking family members of suspects into custody. Recommend that you check to see if, as we were told, some detainees arrive at Abu Ghraib who were detained because the correct target of a raid was not home, so a family member was taken in his place, who would then be released when the target turns himself in. This practice, if it is being done, has a hostage feel to it. Army combat units were part of the problem, Harrington suggested. Looking at them reminded him of his time in Vietnam, when he saw such units alienate local populations. They were often heavy-handed, reliant on massive firepower, and could undo in a few hours what we had striven to accomplish with the people for months. A radically different, far more sophisticated approach was needed, Harrington suggested. Set up an amnesty program and induce insurgent leaders to turn themselves in. There were three good ways to put an insurgent out of business. The preferable way was to foster desertion. The second best was to capture and interrogate them. Last resort is to target and kill them. Yet that last thinking was at the heart of the approach that Sanchez and many of his division commanders were taking, especially in the Sunni Triangle. Overall, Harrington concluded, the Army should change its way of thinking about what it was doing in Iraq. Keep the U.S. profile as low as possible going forward, he wrote. Effectively, the veteran interrogator had turned the Sanchez critique on its head. It's not intelligence that is the problem here. It is your troops and tactics. Alter your tactics, and your intelligence will improve, just as night follows day. Only two copies of the report were made, with Harrington keeping one and leaving the other with Fast. There is no indication that General Sanchez, the most conventional of commanders, was interested in overhauling his approach in such a revolutionary way. 4 months later, orders issued to his subordinate commanders still routinely called for killing or capturing the insurgents. The U.S. military response to the rise of the insurgency was fundamentally misguided. An effort to squeeze out more intelligence involving thousands of American troops and profoundly disrupting the lives of tens of thousands of Iraqis swamped the intelligence system. The American offensive was undone by a combination of overwhelmed soldiers and indiscriminate generals, especially the 4th ID's Odierno, who sent too many detainees south, and his immediate superior Sanchez, who should have seen this and stopped it. Yet what General Odierno and the 4th ID are remembered for is something very different. In fact, for what may be the high point of the U.S. occupation. We got 'em, Bremer exclaimed to reporters on December 14th. After 38 weeks of searching, Operation Red Dawn, involving 600 conventional and special operations troops, had caught Saddam Hussein hiding in a hole on a farmstead near the village of Dawr, 10 miles southeast of Tikrit, and not far from his birthplace of Auja. An informant had said that an important person was there amid the palm groves and orange orchards. One soldier noticed a prayer rug over a dirt spot that looked swept recently. The rug was removed, and a styrofoam lid was found underneath it. After it was lifted, carefully, in case it was booby-trapped, it revealed a square-cut hole resembling a mine shaft. Under standard procedures, said Colonel James Hickey, the smart, sad-eyed commander of the operation, soldiers would have dropped a grenade or fired into the spider hole. But before they could, two hands appeared in surrender. Saddam was taken into custody by a combination of special operations troops and members of the 4th Infantry Division. At last, some commanders thought, the corner had been turned. Not only had Saddam been caught, he hadn't even put up a fight, a circumstance that appeared to undercut the heroic image he had tried to construct. Bremer presented the moment to Iraqis as a potential turning point in the life of their nation. This is a great day in your history, he said. With the arrest of Saddam Hussein, there is a new opportunity for members of the former regime, whether military or civilian, to end their bitter opposition. Let them come forward now in a spirit of reconciliation and hope, lay down their arms, and join you, their fellow citizens, in the task of building the new Iraq. Some U.S. commanders, caught up in the euphoria of the moment, said at the time that they believed it was the beginning of the end of the insurgency. The Wicked Witch is dead, rejoiced Lieutenant Colonel Henry Arnold, a battalion commander in the 101st Airborne based near the Syrian border. The capture of Saddam Hussein will have a tremendous negative impact on the Ba'athist insurgency, and it's all good news for us in the future of Iraq. He predicted that most of the former regime elements, or FRE, active in the insurgency now would be demoralized. I believe that the majority of the FRE will melt away and begin to reintegrate into normal society. I think this puts a nail in the coffin of hopes that the Ba'ath Party could ever regain control of Iraq, an army general said. There is no longer any central figure around whom such a movement could coalesce. Indeed, In the next few weeks, the U.S. military obtained the best information it had seen in months. The peak was in the December time frame after we took down Saddam and captured him, General Sanchez said in a legal statement given later in legal proceeding. On Christmas Eve, Fadil Mohammed Ahmed, who is believed to be commanding former members of the regime and launching attacks in Baghdad, turned himself in. January and February 2004 were good times for U.S. military intelligence, recalled one senior officer. We were rolling up the Ba'athists, he said. We had them on their heels in Diyala and Al-Anbar, the provinces flanking Baghdad on the east and west. At one point, some 500 insurgent fighters petitioned for amnesty, he said. This might have been the moment for a political opening to the Sunnis, capitalizing on the stunning capture by reaching out to wavering enemies, said an army intelligence officer who was based in Anbar at the time. I think we missed an incredible opportunity to bring the Sunnis into the fold during that December-January time frame, he said. A lot of infrastructure spending and a push to reach out to religious and tribal leaders could potentially have changed the course of the war. But neither the CPA nor the Bush administration was inclined to offer reprieves, recalled the first officer. That was the great missed opportunity, he said with palpable regret. At the time, Sanchez was hearing reassuring reports from subordinate commanders. The number of attacks appeared to be dwindling. The 4th ID's Major General Odierno contended that the back of insurgency was broken. The former regime elements we have been combating have been brought to their knees, he told reporters. Capturing Saddam was a major operational and psychological defeat for the enemy. But even at the time of the capture, there were indications that the ultimate payoff wouldn't be as good as commanders hoped. That was a very unpopular event in Al-Anbar province, recalled Keith Mines. They didn't like to see the whole thing of checking his teeth on TV. They thought he should be handled with dignity. He emphasized this in his weekly update to Bremer, recording that he was seeing outrage at how Iraq's former leader had been publicly humiliated. Nor did the display of Saddam play well in other parts of the Arab world. No Arab and no Muslim will ever forget these images. They touched something very, very deep, a Moroccan journalist named Khalid Jamai told Reuters, the news service. It was disgraceful to publish those pictures. It goes against human dignity to present him like a gorilla that has come out of the forest with someone checking his head for lice. Ultimately, the capture of Saddam would prove to be the prelude to a new, more determined phase of the war. It is possible that removing Saddam from the equation made it easier for some of the Iraqis who hated Saddam, but also disliked the Americans, to support the insurgency. We are not fighting for Saddam, Ahmed Jassim, a religious student in Fallujah, said around this time. We are fighting for our country, for our honor, for Islam. We are not doing this for Saddam. Back in Washington, frustration with Bremer was growing. He ignored my suggestions, recalled Wolfowitz. He ignored Rumsfeld's suggestions. One day late in 2003, while sailing in the Mediterranean, Larry Ellison, founder and chief executive of Oracle, the big software company, received a phone call from the Pentagon. Can we borrow General Kellogg, who had retired from the joint staff and gone to work for the software giant? Sure, Ellison replied. The CPA was limping, staffed at 54% of its estimated requirement, and Kellogg remembered many of those were young, inexperienced, and didn't speak the language. He went out to try to fix things, and especially to repair a relationship with the U.S. military that had turned adversarial. Early on, Kellogg set up a back channel to Rice's office in the White House, in part because Rice had asked him to provide ground truth, he said, and partly because he soon came to believe that Bremer was misleading Washington on how much progress he was making. For example, Bremer would tell congressional delegations that there were 100,000 Iraqi security forces trained. I sent a back channel message to Wolfowitz and Rice saying, "You're setting yourself up. This number isn't right. I am overseeing the training and there are just 10,000. I also told them that electricity was much worse than they thought. Rumsfeld's response was to send out survey teams that could determine the facts on the ground. Bremer objected to the first team, and its trip was canceled, Kellogg recalled. The second team was led by Major General Carl Eikenberry, an Army general fresh from working on training issues in Afghanistan. He reviewed the training of Iraqi police and military units and concluded that things weren't going well. U.S. commanders told members of the assessment team that the insurgency was growing much faster than the Iraqi security forces. Bing West, a member of the team, noted in his account of U.S. military operations in Anbar province. The CPA was overseeing the training of the Iraqis while the U.S. military was trying to use those forces. To fix the program, Eikenberry decided all training and employment of Iraqi forces should be consolidated under the U.S. military. You can't have disunity of command in the middle of a war, said the briefing Eikenberry's team prepared for Bremer, according to West, who helped write it. We have split authority from responsibility. When Eikenberry apprised Bremer of his plan to recommend the shift, Kellogg recalled, Bremer just unloaded on him. It's not going to happen. It's wrong. I'll go to the president on this. I'll go to Rumsfeld. West had a more succinct summary. Bremer went batshit. But what Bremer didn't know was that Eikenberry held his own trump card, and he played it, taking the recommendation to Abizaid, the top U.S. commander in the region, and his close friend, since the two were roommates in the West Point class of 1973. They had remained close ever since, a fairly unusual duo in Army culture. Quirky intellectuals in a peer group that is, as one former officer once noted, more inclined to read bass fishing magazine than serious military history. Both hold advanced degrees from Harvard and speak non-Western languages, Abizaid Arabic and Eikenberry Chinese. A few months later, Eikenberry's consolidation recommendation was implemented, with Petraeus sent back to Iraq to oversee all training of Iraqi security forces, from the Army and the National Guard to Border Patrol, Interior Security, and Police. Chapter 12, The Descent into Abuse, Summer and Fall, 2003. Colonel Joe Anderson, the energetic commander of the brigade of the 101st Airborne that was headquartered in Mosul, was told one evening late in 2003 by his intelligence officer that soldiers at their detention center had reported that one of their Iraqi prisoners had a broken jaw. As such incidents go, it was routine, similar to dozens of others that occurred across Iraq during the first phase of the American occupation. Yet a warning bell went off in Anderson's head. I was suspicious, he said later. When people fall down, they sustain a broken nose or a cut chin, but jawbones are broken by a blow. They said he fell. What's more, news of the incident came just after the 101st had suffered its worst month ever of casualties while in Iraq, losing 25 soldiers in November. And Anderson knew his soldiers wanted payback. Guys get pissed when they see their buddies blown away, he said. He understood the emotions, but felt strongly that it shouldn't be expressed through illegal or immoral acts. He ordered an informal inquiry, which soon turned into a formal investigation. On December 19, the investigation board concluded that the injury was caused either by the Iraqi being struck or caused to fall. In either case, the harm was the result of intentional acts by coalition forces. The soldier directly involved was issued a letter of reprimand, but that was the least of the consequences. The investigation had uncovered a host of other problems. The detainees were being systematically and intentionally mistreated, one investigator wrote. I saw the chief throw them down, put his knee in his neck and back, and grind them into the floor, one witness stated. He would use a bullhorn and yell at them in Arabic and play heavy metal music extremely loud. They got so scared they would urinate on themselves. He was very aggressive and rough with detainees. Prisoners were also made to exercise until they couldn't stand, and then were doused in cold water. Some were made to wear sandbags on their heads, on which were written IED, signifying to soldiers, incorrectly in most cases it appears, that their wearer had been caught trying to bomb U.S. troops. Most important, investigators reported, the brigade detention center was being run by a military intelligence battalion untrained for the job. They knew how to interrogate prisoners, not how to guard and house them. Anderson and his commander, Petraeus, reacted with alacrity, Control of the detention facility was transferred almost instantly from the military intelligence battalion to a military police unit that knew how to manage prisoners, Anderson said. Latrines were moved closer to the holding area to minimize the chances that prisoners would trip while being escorted. Fences were erected so detainees could move outside the building while still being controlled. Floodlights were installed. Also, the word went out across the division that abuse wouldn't be tolerated. Tone is very important, Petraeus said much later. People say this is a squad leader's war, but what generals can do is set tone. In addition, to ensure a layer of oversight, Petraeus reached out to the Red Cross and to local religious, political, and civic leaders, inviting them to inspect the 101st's detention facilities often, to talk to prisoners, and to bring any problems to his attention. In the next 2 months, there was only one case of possible abuse detected, Anderson noted, and that was an ambiguous situation. In his view, the quick reaction to the broken jaw incident was characteristic of the division's style. We were constantly assessing our operations. Were we doing it right? Going after the right people? Having the effects we wanted to have, Anderson said. Dealing with detainees was just part of this. In historical terms, the 101st's broken jaw incident was minor, hardly worth remembering, but for the swift and effective response of its leaders. Other divisions posted far different records of abuse than the 101st. It wasn't that soldiers were ordered to be cruel. It is that acts of cruelty were tolerated in some units, to the point that one officer in the 82nd Airborne, Captain Ian Fishback, would later charge that it was systematic. The atmosphere of official lawlessness in some Army units is significant for several reasons. It demeaned all those involved. It usually was militarily ineffective and counterproductive, and it tarnished the image of the United States and its military. When a policeman abuses or tortures a suspect, it inevitably diminishes the officer's humanity, wrote French Army Captain Pierre-Henri Simon, who was a prisoner of the Germans during World War II, and a decade later, a critic of his country's behavior during the Algerian Revolution. But when a soldier uses abuse or torture, Simon argued, it is worse, because it is here that the honor of the nation becomes engaged. Much of the initial mistreatment of Iraqis by American troops seemed to be the results of soldiers not being trained or mentally prepared for the mission. Faced with looting and unable to speak the language of the people they were trying to police, many soldiers flailed, using force ineffectively or brutally. It is not uncommon to hear American soldiers explain that the only thing the Iraqis understand is force, Army Reserve Major Christopher Varhola, an anthropologist who traveled widely in Iraq, later noted. For the most part, however, the people saying this do not speak Arabic and have had little or no interaction with Iraqis. An incident involving the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment captures the Army's predicament during the summer of 2003. It was the finest fighting force in the world for conventional combat, but it was ill-prepared for the irregular war in which it found itself. In this sense, abusive soldiers sometimes were victims of the Army's lack of preparation. One officer in the 2nd ACR, which was assigned to Eastern Baghdad in the summer of 2003, recalled to an Army investigator that when he brought looters back to his base, a commander there told my sergeant that he didn't want them here. Then he told my platoon sergeant to take them out back and beat the fuck out of them, an account supported by other soldiers. Shocked, the sergeant went back outside and told his soldiers what the senior officer had said. I told my squad leaders what Bulldog 6 told me to do with all the looters, the sergeant continued in a written statement. I told them we are not going to do that. American soldiers were better than that, in his view. But still wanting to make a point to the looters, he ordered that they be taken to the base's front gate, stripped naked, and set loose. He was trying to do the right thing, but he had violated the rules governing the treatment of detainees, an offense for which he was later charged. The lack of preparation was also reflected in an incident involving soldiers in the 1st Armored Division. On the fly, they had devised a method of discriminating among the Iraqis they detained for looting. Those who, when captured, stared back at their captors were considered likely to loot again, but those who cried in fear were deemed to be deterred. On June 20, 2003, a lieutenant told soldiers to move a looter out of a truck. The officer was going to make him cry. I was standing at the front of our truck when I saw the, name deleted, put the guy on his knees and put a gun to the back of his head, a soldier said in a sworn statement. Then he bent down and said something to the guy. I didn't hear because I was too far away. Then I saw him stand up and shoot. The barrel of the weapon was just high enough to miss the guy. The officer claimed in a statement that he fired his weapon to scare away a feral dog, but six soldiers testified that they hadn't seen any such animal. Two nights later, a sergeant in the same platoon followed suit. This second incident occurred when an Iraqi man and his two teenage sons were detained for looting. The sergeant radioed his lieutenant, who asked, "Are they crying yet?" The sergeant then told the father he was going to shoot one of the boys, according to an army investigator's report. "Which one will it be?" he asked. "No, please shoot me, don't shoot my sons," the man responded, as would most fathers. The sergeant repeated the question twice, according to another soldier's affidavit. Then he walked one of the boys around to the far side of a truck, where they couldn't be seen, and fired his pistol by the boy's head. The three were then let go. Many soldiers were troubled by such behavior. In this case, a soldier from another unit stated, "I reported the incident to my platoon sergeant and told him that I didn't want to work with these guys again." The strategic confusion about why the United States was in Iraq, such as the Bush administration's insistence that the war was part of the counterattack against Al-Qaeda-style terrorism, and so was somehow a response to the 9/11 attacks, may have led some American soldiers to treat ordinary Iraqis as if they were terrorists. Some indeed were. But many, certainly the majority of those raided and detained, were just average Iraqis, not necessarily sympathetic to the U.S. presence, but not actually taking up arms against it, at least before they were humiliated or incarcerated. Of all the major conventional combat units operating in Iraq in 2003, the one that most consistently raised eyebrows was General Odierno's 4th Infantry Division. The warning signals, first picked up by the Marines who temporarily occupied Tikrit in April 2003, grew steadily louder. In July, a member of a psychological operations team attached to the 4th's Artillery Brigade, which was known as Task Force Iron Gunner, filed a formal complaint about how its soldiers treated Iraqis. Artillery units seem to have been particularly prone to abuse in Iraq, perhaps because their core mission involves indirect fire, which may make them less comfortable with face-to-face confrontation. PSYOPs and civil affairs are parts of the Special Operations Command, but in Iraq, they were frequently placed under the command of regular combat units, such as infantry, armor, or artillery, where they often were unhappy with what they saw. In this case, the PSYOP specialist said his team was especially concerned that the brigade's commander was employing ineffective tactics. Few of the raids and detentions executed by Task Force Iron Gunner have resulted in the capture of any anti-coalition members or the seizure of illegal weapons, he wrote. He placed the blame squarely with the artillery unit's commander, Colonel Kevin Stramara. This team has witnessed the colonel initiate these events. He charged that detention practices were capricious, sometimes based on the whim of the commander, or because more than $100 in Iraqi dinars had been found in someone's possession. One day in June, the PSYOP soldier said, a Bradley fighting vehicle had opened fire on a house, causing it to burst into flames. In a separate incident, a father of a 12-year-old boy who had been accidentally killed by U.S. forces and then buried was made to dig up the body himself. In a subsequent sworn statement, this member of the team, whose name was blacked out in the documents released by the Army, conceded that some of his charges were based on hearsay, but he stood by his bottom line. My overall feeling of the treatment of the civilian population is negative. I go out to the civilian community about 3 times a week to communicate with the Iraqi population to get an overall assessment of how the people see us. Through interpretation, the Iraqi people ask us why we are so unfair to them. One of the sworn statements filed by a civilian employee of the Defense Department working at the brigade's jail, apparently as an interpreter, although he didn't say so, seem to back up that conclusion. I think 80% of the people we bring in are at the wrong place at the wrong time and have no intelligence value, he said. The Army's investigation found credible explanations for most of the specific charges. The house was fired on, the investigation concluded, because it had a bunker on its roof that was found to contain mortars and artillery rounds. The dead boy was buried because there was no place to keep his body, and unearthed without U.S. help because the family had asked that there be no U.S. participation. But the fundamental question of whether the brigade's tactics were misguided wasn't addressed by the investigation. There was one unexpected bit of fallout from this inquiry. Investigators learned that Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, commander of an artillery battalion in Stramara's brigade, had threatened one night in August to kill an Iraqi prisoner, fired his pistol next to the man's head, and been present while the man, a policeman, was beaten. Trying to obtain information about an alleged assassination plot against him in the town of Sabah al-Bur, West had personally questioned the policeman, who had been taken prisoner as a suspected member of the conspiracy. "We're here for one reason, and that's to find out who's trying to kill me," West said as he entered the detainee's cell, according to the young soldier who served as the gunner on West's Humvee. Everyone questioned by investigators agreed that West then removed his 9mm pistol from its holster and told the detainee he would be shot if he did not provide information. First, the female interpreter kicked the man. Then the gunner grabbed him and shouted, "Who the fuck is trying to kill him?" Then, according to several accounts, everyone in the room but West beat the man for some time, about an hour or so, according to one private. During this assault, the Iraqi kept contradicting himself, and he would say, "I love you," to Lieutenant Colonel West, cry and scream, a staff sergeant told investigators. West then took the man outside. "Either you answer the questions or die tonight," West said, according to his gunner. He then had two soldiers hold the man's head inside a clearing barrel, a sand-filled oil barrel that is tipped sideways and which soldiers use when returning to a base to ensure that there isn't a live round in the weapon's firing chamber. "If you don't start giving answers, I will kill you," West said, according to one of the soldiers who held the man. West then fired one or two shots past the prisoner's ear into the barrel. As Lieutenant Colonel West pulled the trigger, the individual went stiff, this soldier added. At that point, the senior sergeant present decided he had seen enough. "Sir, I don't think he knows," he said to West. "It was something I had never experienced before, and don't care to again," the sergeant first class added in his statement. "Put him back in the cell," West responded. West then reported his actions to his commander, but nothing happened until the officers conducting the general investigation of the climate of command in the brigade stumbled across the incident. "I accept full responsibility for my actions and accept punishment," West wrote in a sworn statement a month later. "I acted in the best interest for my soldiers and, yes, myself." He ultimately was charged with aggravated assault, fined $5,000, removed from his position as a commander, and then retired from the military. "I was and am proud to say that I never lost a troop in combat engagement in my time as a battalion commander," West, who went on to teach high school in Florida, said a year later. "We were tough, and it kept my men alive and Iraqis in my area secure. We also let the local people know that we would not tolerate attacks and that our response would be quick and equitable, not wanton violence. Rules and regulations are necessary and proper, but I have never seen one cry at a funeral or accept an American flag after it had been taken off a casket of one of my fallen comrades." That view represents the logical outcome of making force protection a top priority in U.S. military operations. Every commander wants to take care of his or her troops, and few of West's peers would fault him for his concern. Yet the relentless pursuit of that goal can undercut what should be a higher priority for the commander: winning. After all, if keeping soldiers alive is the top goal, that could be achieved simply staying at home. A few months later, another 4th ID soldier, the staff sergeant overseeing the interrogation section at the division's main detainee holding pen in Tikrit, was reprimanded after an Iraqi was beaten with a baton while being questioned. "These acts could bring extreme discredit upon the U.S. Army," Lieutenant Colonel Conrad Christman, The commander of the 104th Military Intelligence Battalion warned him in writing on November 6. The incidents of abuse of the detainee, his letter added, show a lack of supervisory judgment on your part. Surprisingly, the sergeant hurled those very conclusions straight back at his chain of command. His detailed and eloquent response amounted to a powerful critique of the U.S. Army's entire approach to Iraq. What previous cases of abuse had implied, he now stated explicitly. The Army wasn't prepared for this mission, so soldiers were being trained, equipped, and led poorly. With the exception of myself, all interrogators at the TFIHICE, Task Force Iron Horse Interrogation Control Element, were and most remain inexperienced at actual interrogation, wrote the sergeant. The division's intelligence efforts generally were cursory, he added, because of insufficient personnel, time, and resources. Nor had the Army prepared the sergeant and his soldiers for the job they'd been assigned. Our unit has never trained for detention facility operations because our unit is neither designed nor intended for this mission. My soldiers are assigned a mission for which they have not trained, are not manned, are not equipped, are not supplied, and cannot effectively accomplish. What's more, he wrote, the institutional Army hadn't even taken the proper steps to prepare for this kind of war. To my knowledge, no field manual covers counterinsurgency interrogation operations. But most striking from this NCO was a lengthy denunciation of the strategic confusion of those leading the Army in Iraq. This was, after all, not a stately war college symposium or a retired colonel pondering the past in the quiet of his study, but a staff sergeant writing in the field under near-combat conditions, responding to a formal admonition issued 3 days earlier. He laid the mess squarely at the feet of General Odierno and other top officers in the 4th ID. I firmly believe that, name of subordinate soldier redacted in document, took the actions he did partially due to his perception of the command climate of the division as a whole. Comments made by senior leaders regarding detainees such as, they are not enemy prisoners of war, they are terrorists and will be treated as such, have caused a great deal of confusion as to the status of detainees. In Iraq, the NCO also reported signs of U.S. forces practicing a form of hostage-taking, detaining family members of suspected insurgents in order to compel those suspects to surrender. Personnel at the ICE regularly see detainees who are, in essence, hostages, he charged. They are normally arrested by coalition forces because they are family of individuals who have been targeted by a brigade based on accusations that may or may not be true, to be released supposedly when and if the targeted individual surrenders to coalition forces. In fact, the U.S. tended not to keep its end of the bargain because the detention system was so badly operated. In reality, these detainees are transferred to Abu Ghraib prison and become lost in the coalition detention system regardless of whether the targeted individual surrenders himself. This coercive taking of such prisoners had at least the tacit approval of senior leaders in the division, he said, because it had been discussed in front of them at briefings. The military intelligence commander, Christman, impressed by the staff sergeant's arguments, came to think that it would be wrong to fault him for lack of supervision, and so decided against making the written reprimand part of the staff sergeant's permanent record. It became apparent to me that, since we were dealing with far too many detainees for the small number of personnel and the limited facilities we had available, a close supervisory relationship was not feasible, he later explained. On September 21, 2003, Odierno issued a memorandum on the treatment of detainees to everyone in his division. Soldiers will treat all detainees with dignity and respect, and, at the very least, will meet the standards for humane treatment as articulated in international law, he ordered. While detainees in U.S. custody may be interrogated for intelligence purposes, the use of physical or mental torture or coercion to compel individuals to provide information is strictly prohibited. Neither the stresses of combat nor deep provocation will justify inhumane treatment. That sounded good, but it isn't clear how much effect it had. A subsequent review by the Army Inspector General said, interrogators reported detainees arriving at the cage badly beaten, Many beatings occurred after the detainees were zip-tied by some units in 4ID. Some units wouldn't take THTs, tactical human intelligence teams, on raids, because they didn't want oversight of activities that might cross the line during capture. An investigation by Human Rights Watch found that soldiers in Iraq sometimes would lie about injuries inflicted in interrogations, having learned that there would be no questions asked if they told medical assistants that the damage had been done during the capture. Perhaps the best way to judge the 4ID was that the division succeeding it chose a sharply different course of operations. Major General John Batiste, who commanded the 1st Infantry Division, which took over from the 4th ID in the spring of 2004, declined to discuss the operations of the 4th ID, but emphasized that in his own unit, from day one, that it was essential to treat people with dignity, even captured insurgents. As Petraeus had done in the north, Batiste established a detailed set of procedures for his jails and brought in sheikhs and imams to inspect his facilities. "I told commanders that they would be responsible for everything that happened in them," Batiste said. "They all conformed to the Geneva Conventions, to the rule of law, and to my sense of what was right from the way I was brought up." And like Petraeus, he had only one notable instance of abuse, and that happened not in a detention facility, but when a sergeant appears to have had a nervous breakdown during field operations. One day in the spring of 2004, Major General James Mattis was walking out of a mess hall in Al-Asad in western Iraq when he saw a knot of his troops intently hunched over a television, watching a cable news show. Marines weren't usually so attentive to current events. "What's going on?" Mattis asked. It was, he learned, the revelations about Abu Ghraib, along with sickening photos of cruelty and humiliation. A 19-year-old lance corporal glanced up from the television and told the general, "Some assholes have just lost the war for us." The detainee abuses that would resonate most took place not out in the divisions operating in the provinces, but on the outskirts of the capital, in the Abu Ghraib prison. All of the Army's problems in Iraq in 2003, poor planning, clumsy leadership, strategic confusion, counterproductive tactics, undermanning, being overly reactive, came together in the treatment of prisoners, a wide-ranging scandal that eventually was summarized in the phrase Abu Ghraib, after the big prison west of Baghdad, where many prisoners wound up and where some were tortured. The mess at Abu Ghraib arguably began on October 1, 2003, when Staff Sergeant Ivan Chip Frederick II and Specialist Charles Grainer Jr. arrived there as part of the advance party for the 372nd Military Police Company, an Army Reserve unit from rural Cressoptown, Maryland, in the Appalachian foothills. They were part of a larger, troubled unit that until September had been based in southern Iraq. Many had deployed to the country that spring to handle the flood of enemy POWs that war planners had expected, but that had never materialized. Their mission completed, they had expected, like many other soldiers in Iraq that spring, to go home sooner rather than later. Instead, the reservists were assigned a new mission. Someone had to run the Iraqi prison system, and in the absence of an Iraqi government, they were handed the job. Their morale plummeted, an official army inquiry later found. Some began exaggerating medical complaints, such as back pains, to get evacuated out of the country. Their brigade commander, Brigadier General Karpinski, later complained. In mid-October, the 372nd took responsibility from a Nevada-based MP unit for Tiers 1A and 1B, the permanent concrete-walled part of the prison. Called 1-Alpha, or the hard site, by the soldiers, this was the cell block where interrogations took place and where detainees believed to possess useful information were kept. Other prisoners, deemed to be of less intelligence value, lived in tents in an open area. Just how poorly prisoners had been treated during the summer, before the 372nd MPs arrived, is a matter of dispute. Some had been kept naked and handcuffed to bars, and others were made to wear women's underwear on their heads, according to Frederick's statement. What is not in question is that once Grainer and Frederick took control of the night shift on Tier 1A, they wasted little time in going on a rampage of abuse. "I took it to another level," Frederick said in a sworn statement given much later to Army investigators. The torture of detainees was first recorded photographically on October 17, according to the timestamp from one of the digital cameras the MPs used. Grainer was a picture person. He loved taking pictures, Frederick said in his confessional declaration. Grainer took pictures all the time. Indeed, according to Frederick's sworn statement, Grainer went so far as to have Frederick photograph him while he was being filleted in a prison supply room by Private First Class Lindy England, another member of the unit who had become Grainer's girlfriend. In one photo, England is giving the thumbs up she would later use in photos of detainee abuse. The October 17 photo showed a man stripped naked and handcuffed to his cell door. The next day, an Iraqi man was photographed handcuffed to a cot, with women's underwear draped over his head. About a week later, official accounts differ on the precise date, PFC England posed holding a dog's leash that had at the other end a naked detainee, nicknamed Gus by the MPs. On October 25, naked Iraqi men with their hands cuffed and legs shackled were piled on their backs like cordwood. Adele Nakla, a civilian working as a translator on contract, said in a statement later that they handcuffed their hands together and their legs with shackles and started to stack them on top of each other by ensuring that the bottom guy's penis will touch the guy on top's butt. In the following nights, detainees were kept naked, with some forced to masturbate in front of female soldiers. On November 4, a detainee was hooded and placed on a box and had wires attached to him that he was told would electrocute him if he stepped off the box. On the same night, a CIA detainee died in custody on Tier 1B, having been beaten by the Navy SEALs who had captured him. One detainee later described to Army investigators being made to bark like a dog, being forced to crawl on his stomach while MPs spit and urinated on him, and being struck, causing unconsciousness. He also said he had been sodomized with a stick. Investigators found it highly probable that his allegations were accurate. Many, if not all, of these acts were violations of the Geneva Conventions concerning the treatment of prisoners of war and of civilian noncombatants. Most notably, Article 3 of the 1949 Convention stated that people being detained shall be treated humanely, without outrages on personal dignity, in particular humiliating and degrading treatment. The abuses occurred not only because of the failings of those who committed them, but because of the lack of supervision and leadership by their superiors. One reason for this was that everyone was overworked, taking 12-hour shifts in a hostile environment, frequently for 7 days a week. Yet good officers know their soldiers, and part of that is knowing who to keep an eye on. They also enforce discipline, so that other soldiers understand that the unit has standards that all its members are responsible for. Yet here, leaders didn't supervise or lead, and other soldiers lack the discipline to stop the sadistic acts, or at least to report them. Abu Ghraib was falling apart. Even in a nation sinking into chaos, the prison stood out as particularly troubled. It was regularly being shelled by mortars. Prisoners were routinely escaping. No one knows exactly how many, but at least 36. On November 5, during the night shift's watch, several fled Tier 1A. 2 days later, another detainee went missing. The next day, 5 or 6 left. Note, no power, no water. Prison in state of lockdown, a soldier wrote in the 1 Alpha log on November 17, 2003. Army teams with working dogs arrived at the prison on November 20, and 4 days later were used to abuse prisoners, the day an MP was shot with a smuggled pistol. Using dogs to scare prisoners was called the doggy dance, according to Frederick. On November 24, the prisoners rioted, resulting in the shooting deaths of 9 and injuries to 9 U.S. troops. A subsequent Army report concluded, contributing factors were lack of comprehensive training of guards, poor or non-existent standard operating procedures, no formal guard mount conducted prior to shift, no rehearsals or ongoing training, the mix of less-than-lethal rounds with lethal rounds and weapons, no after-action reviews being conducted after incidents, rules of engagement not posted and not understood, overcrowding, uniforms not standardized, and poor communications between the command and soldiers. But to Karpinski, the female MP general overseeing detention operations in Iraq, that catalog of missteps merely reflected the lack of support she was getting from her superiors. A few months later, she would be blamed by the Army as the senior-most officer to have made grave mistakes in handling Abu Ghraib. She would argue in her own defense that she had worked to call attention to her problems and had sought help from the top commanders in Iraq, generally in vain. In November, as the Ramadan offensive surged, the 82nd Airborne's commanding general, Swanick, came to see her. The eastern boundary of his division's area of operations ran up against Abu Ghraib, and he wanted to know about her security arrangements. "What platforms do you have?" he asked her. He was asking a basic commander's question. "Do you have Humvees, armored Humvees, Bradley fighting vehicles? How do your soldiers investigate enemy movement or respond to attacks?" "None, sir," Karpinski responded. "What weapons do you have?" Swanick asked. "Just M-16s, saws," she said, referring to the Army's basic rifle and the light machine gun known as a squad automatic weapon. These were the most basic arms a unit could have, but nothing that any platoon leader would want as his only tools available for combat. Such light weaponry was useless, for example, against mortar attacks, which could be fired from miles away, and which needed mortars or artillery pieces for an adequate response, as well as a sophisticated counter-battery radar system to detect the point of origin of the enemy fire. His own troops worked constantly to hone their response time on mortars.